Hello and welcome to This Week in Wealth. I'm Alex Steger and I am joined today by a plethora of reporters or journalists. What is the collective noun?
Gaggle?
A gaggle of reporters? A rash of reporters could be right. Anyway, I'm joined by an awful lot of other journalists today in the room. So very quickly, I'm going to go around. I'm joined, as ever, by CityWire RIA editor Ian Wenick.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
Excellent. I'm joined by Sam Bojarski, senior reporter, CityWire RIA, frequent guest on the pod.
Good to be back.
Alec Rich, reporter, CityWire RIA. Also, regular or frequent? I'm not sure what the right description
is.
Yeah,
I don't know if I've been upgraded to a series regular, but frequent, I think, is fine.
Regular. And then making her debut today, Faye Kilburn, RAA reporter, senior reporter, CityWire RAA. Fantastic to have you on the pod, Faye.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be here.
Excellent. So we've got an awful lot to get through. It's also a special day for other reasons too. So it is the Padres are in town, Ian.
Yes.
Which is exciting for you at least anyway, and for a few other Padres fans.
There were 35,000 people at the stadium on Tuesday night.
I assume some of those are Mets fans though, to be fair.
They were mostly there for the $5 beer.
Okay, well, that is a good reason to go somewhere. And less relevant, it's also my son's birthday. So just a lot going on here. And a lot of news to get through, which maybe you won't be massively surprised about, listener, as we've got five people on this podcast. So given we've got so much to get through, let's get into it. Now, we trailed this last week. We were originally going to do another special podcast on our 50 Growers report, and we were going to dive into three related features that we've written off of the back of that. That was going to be the full pod, but fortunately, I think yesterday, so 6 p.m.-ish, we broke probably one of the biggest stories of the year in RAA land. And I've buried the lead here, but I'll get to it now. That is that Charles Schwab is once again raising the AUM threshold at which it will refer out brokerage clients to independent RAAs in its referral network. Ian, Sam, you were two of the three people that broke it. The other person was Andrew Forsh. We couldn't have everyone on the pod, so by dint of location, he missed out. Ian, let's get into it. What's the story? And then we'll get into why this matters so much.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but I think this is one of the stories of the year. So basically what we broke collectively on Tuesday is that Charles Schwab is raising the minimum client asset threshold at which it can send a client out from its brokerage business to an RAA from $2 million to $5 million, and that this change is going to take effect in January of 2027. Now, for some context, we broke last year that Charles Schwab was raising the minimum from $500,000 to $2 million. So we're talking about a 10x increase in the threshold at which a Schwab financial consultant can refer a client to an RAA in the span of a little more than a year.
Right, so we broke that, when did we break that?
Around October, September of 2025.
And it went into force start of
2026.
Start of 26. So start of 26, it went from 500 grand to 2 million. And then this change will come in at the start of 2027. Yeah, so yes. It is, yeah, it's in a year, isn't it? That's wild. Okay, so what was the rationale the last time they did it? And why have they just gone not 7 months later, or 8 months later, why have they gone, actually, do you know what? 2 mil's nowhere near enough. We're going to more than double it.
Yeah, I mean, one of Schwab's stated reasons was basically to like give RAAs a crack at some of these like higher net worth clients, like some of these ultra net worth folks who have, more complicated situations, complicated financial pictures. But this also comes amid Schwab investing a lot more in its like in-house wealth management offering.
Okay, so I think there's sort of two separate things there. So one is the what they're saying and one is the what they're doing. So let's just stick with the what they're saying for now and then we'll come on to the what they're doing and or sort of, potential ulterior motives, if that's maybe not too kind of nefarious a term to use. So they're effectively saying when they raised it to 2 million, their argument was we hadn't raised it for a very long time and really and truly the net worths of people have changed. What an advisor client looks like over that time has changed considerably. Basically, 500 grand used to be a lot. now 2 million is sort of the client sort of size. Why five then? Why a year later they're going to actually five?
So they claim, this is what a Schwab spokesperson told us, they claim that more than half of the flows into Schwab's referral program, the Schwab Advisor Network, which is where RAs get these referrals, they say that more than half the net flows come from clients with 10 million or more in investable assets. So they claim that raising the minimum to 5 million, I'm going to direct quote, aligns the program with where it is seeing the strongest growth and how clients are engaging with it today.
Yeah, so effectively they're saying a lot of the flows and a lot of the referrals are for clients well over 5 million anyway. So why not set it at 5 versus 2?
Exactly.
I guess the counter of that would be like, you still capture all that if it's 2. it's not like there are no flows between 2 and 5, for example. They haven't disclosed what they are. They might not be huge. And then that might be the point they're sort of making, but they're not making that explicitly. So I guess that would be one argument against that, if one needs an argument against that, I suppose. And then let's talk about the other thing, Sam, that you mentioned. So this idea, I imagine Schwab would push back on this, but the broader context here is Schwab is trying to capture a bit more of the wealth market for itself to some degree. And they would say, yes, we are doing that, but we're not doing that at the expense of our RIA clients. But they certainly are doing it, whether at whose expense it comes, we'll come on to a different thing. So let's just talk about how they're trying to do that.
They've been pretty vocal about it on earnings calls and things like that, about their efforts to grow their own in-house Schwab Wealth Advisory business. And they have, you know, I mean, like basically at least half their business is retail investors. So they have a, you know, strong stream of potential leads that they could refer over there. But basically in recent years, they've tried to like strengthen the private markets capabilities of their in-house wealth business and some of those like ancillary like trust and estate services and things like that that they offer to clients.
So they effectively, they can service some more complicated needs and more sophisticated clients.
Exactly, yeah.
Just for a moment, both for me and I hope at least some listeners, break down the different sort of services that Schwab has. Maybe Ian, I can come to you on this because there's the brokerage business and then that's different to the wealth business.
Yes. So for context, so we have Schwab's in-house wealth advisory business, which is Schwab Wealth Advisory. And as Sam and I have discussed before, we discussed on this podcast, that Charles Schwab is really actively trying to expand that business from 20 cities to 30 cities by end of 2026. And what that is that's full in-house wealth management, similar to what an RIA is.
Okay, and that's to what Sam was just saying. That's they've expanded alternative offerings, trust services, etc., to make that a more sophisticated offering. And they've literally expanded it. Like they're trying to have more presence in more places.
Trying to hire new financial consultants, things like that. Yeah.
Okay, so there was a big story about this earlier this year, I remember. Okay, and then, but that's separate to
what we think of when we think about Charles Schwab, or what most average investors think, which is the branch offices, which are set around the country, which have the big blue Charles Schwab
square,
logo.
Yeah.
And those are staffed by a financial consultant, which is another word for kind of essentially a broker. They work with wealthy clients of Schwab, whether they're kind of self-directed or not. And then the referrals to RAs come from these financial consultants. And the whole premise of the SAN referral network is that these financial consultants will refer more complex clients out to RAs who custody their business with Charles Schwab. And the idea is that it's essentially risk-free for Schwab because the client assets stay on the platform, and then the RA who gets a referral from Schwab pays Charles Schwab a portion of the assets under management fee charged to the client in perpetuity as long as the client asset stays with the RA. So basically, Schwab's getting an indefinite trail commission for assets it's keeping regardless.
Got it. But, so that's where it came from. And very quickly, let's talk about SAN for a moment because it has evolved a little bit. And I know we talked about it a lot, and I know a lot of listeners will be very familiar with it, but there's been a number of changes. Can we run through some of them and the size and shape of what sort of SAN looks like today versus what it did historically?
So for context, there is a point in which SAN expanded significantly to almost 300 firms because Charles Schwab acquired TD Ameritrade in 2020.
And TD also had a referral network.
Yes, called TD Advisor Direct. Charles Schwab culled a significant number of firms when it merged the two programs together, down to 175. And then at the start of 2025, it was at 100, roughly 140 firms that are.
We don't know what it is since.
We don't know what it
is. Okay. Yes. So that was one change that it made. And then obviously it's made the 500 grand to 2 million now to 5 million. Yes. But it's also made some other changes too.
Yes. The other change, which Sam reported on last year in Broke, which is that Schwab raised the minimum AUM threshold for RIAs to participate in SAN from 250 million to 500 million. So basically, it's gated out smaller RIAs.
And did it change the fees as well?
Yes, so there was also, which we broke in 2025, there was a change, a slight 5% increase in that ongoing effective trail commission that the RIA pays to Schwab. And that fee kind of gradates down as a client gets wealthier, but it starts at a little bit more than, I believe, 26 basis points.
Okay. So is this Schwab trying to keep more of what it was referring out in its own wealth business? Ian, to your point, the referral network as it was risk-free. They were keeping the assets, but I guess they were splitting the fees with advisors. If they have it in their own wealth business, they're not splitting the fees at all with advisors, so they keep a larger part of that. I don't know whether that's, you say that's nefarious or that's just smart business, whatever, you know, depends, I suppose, which side of the fence you sit on that. They've said before, if I have this quote right, I want to attribute it to the right person. Is this from the spokesperson or is this from someone else? The argument, we've scratched the surface in a 37 trillion advice market. They're basically saying there's enough to go around. We can both do this.
Yeah.
We can build our business. Have you spoken to anyone who's annoyed about this?
I've heard mixed things. I mean, some say that they're still getting great leads, but yeah, I've kind of heard rumblings that, yeah, I mean, others aren't so thrilled about the changes.
Yeah, because I guess it's still competitive. You still got to compete for those clients. There are fewer clients now being referred out. So yeah. Okay. Really interesting. Anything else to add on this?
I mean, the way that I really think about this is kind of almost like a boiling frog analogy, and also make connection to kind of what we talk about, some of the long, short SMAs and some of these firms kind of developing their own while having a platform. And the idea is, all right, well, if we're going to take on this risk, why don't we just capture the asset manager revenue, capture more of the economics? And I feel like Schwab is kind of getting to the same conclusion, which is, you know, we have the capability to capture 100% of the unit economics of these clients. Like, the trail commission is nice, but why take 25 basis points if we can take 100 basis points?
Yeah, but then also equally, you know, RIAs might argue that we've fueled your growth as a custodian, and now, you know, hang on a second, you're sort of turning around and saying we're going to prioritize our own business versus yours.
There are people in this industry that have become billionaires because of referrals that Charles Schwab has sent to them.
Yeah. No, true, but also Schwab's built a big business off the back of those RIAs as well. I mean, that's a two-way street also.
Just the way that I kind of see this, and you're going to be shocked, I'm actually putting opinion into a podcast. I find it like inconceivable that in 5 years' time, we're going to see Schwab Advisor Network resemble anything close to what we currently have now.
Really? Wow. Okay. That's a big take. I mean, I was going to also push back on your boiling frog thing. I know boiling frog is gradual. This is pretty, is like you turned up the dial from like 2 to 6, you know, or
I've never cooked or eaten a frog, so I don't really have a lot of context.
You should go to France and you could do the latter of those at least. Excellent. Like, I think we've covered it really well. It's a massive story. And I guess, yeah, let's see how other referral networks adapt, and let's see, obviously, how the industry and RIAs react. And listener, if you have strong opinions on this, if you're an RIA that uses Schwab or is part of the network and wants to let us know what you think one way or the other, email us. Our email is almost as catchy as our URL, news@citywireusa.com. Yeah, that'd be great. We'd love to hear from you. Fantastic. All right. Now, look, I said we've got a lot to get through. As ever, we spent too long on the first story, so we've got to zip through the rest. I've trailed what they are already. We're back on 50 growers and specifically 3 follow-up features that we've done. Sam, I'd like to kick off with you and your piece on the repeat entries. So we've done 7 editions of the 50 growers report. The methodology is the same every time. Do you want me to do the 10 seconds on the methodology?
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. We've talked about this before. But broadly, we're trying to identify the fastest growing RIAs in every state in the country. We take three main factors. So percentage AUM growth, total AUM change in dollars, and headcount at the firm. We combine those things into what we call a growth factor. We obviously screen out firms that aren't pure play financial planning focused RIAs, and then we look at it on a state by state basis. The state by state basis is important because obviously you could be the fastest even growing firm in a less competitive state, and actually look, the reality is you're probably growing slower than maybe the fifth or sixth fastest growing firm in a more competitive state.
Yeah.
But we're trying to get a cross section of the country. Okay, with that methodology, and I suppose to some degree caveats out of the way, Sam, how many firms have been in all seven of our reports?
Well, we found that there's only four that have that distinct honor. And those four firms are a couple names that you might expect, Creative Planning and Carson Group, two of the largest RIAs in the country. And then this firm, Alaska Wealth Advisors, as well as Avior Wealth Management. And Avior is also, like Carson, based in Nebraska.
Okay, so two questions. One, let's zip through the states they're in. Creative Planning is in...
Kansas.
Okay, Carson and Avior are in Nebraska. And the other firm?
Alaska Wealth Advisors, as its name suggests, is based in Alaska.
Fantastic. All right. So let's not talk about Creative and Carson, because I think people know a lot about them. PE-backed, deep pockets, massively acquisitive, were successful, obviously, even before they got that PE-backing, big growth engines. I think they get their airtime. So let's talk about the other two.
Yeah. Alaska Wealth Advisors, based in Anchorage. Obviously, they're in a smaller, well, Alaska's a huge state, but a small...
A less competitive wealth market,
Wealth market. They've grown organically, steadily. They're, you know, closely held, smaller firm, roughly about $1 billion. But they're attributing a lot of their growth to expanding wallet share, you know, clients needing to diversify away from concentrated stock positions, which, you know...
So they're getting more of their existing clients' money.
Yeah, okay, exactly. Exactly. And then the fact that a lot of their employees serve on nonprofit boards in town. I thought that was really interesting.
And that's been a source of referrals, effectively, like working for those nonprofits, meeting effectively wealthy people who can then become clients.
Yeah, referrals, getting their name out there. Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Okay, and Avior, if I'm saying that correctly?
Avior Wealth Management, yeah, they're majority owned by its management, minority backed by Constellation Wealth Capital since 2024.
Constellation, sort of frequent or serial minority stake taker in RIAs.
Yeah, and most of their business seems to be like attributable to organic growth over the years, but they have, I guess, with that Constellation money, entered the M&A markets, and they bought a $500 million RIA at the start of this year. So they're...
Okay, but prior, their appearances prior would have been organic growth because they hadn't made acquisitions before.
Or at least not many. Yeah, okay, wasn't a key part of their model.
And I suppose also we should note of it, Nebraska perhaps isn't the most competitive either. Obviously, Carson's, you know, huge and a sort of a behemoth for the industry, but overall you wouldn't, you know, it's not New York, it's not California, et cetera, et cetera. It's not
Florida. There's not as many RIAs as...
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, yeah. Kansas is a strange one, isn't it? Because you perhaps wouldn't think that it was, but as we've discussed on the podcast before and noted, it is a hub of large, very successful RIAs.
Yeah.
Sam, very quickly, any other sort of takeaways from your deep dive into sort of repeats and people who've been on, or indeed debutants?
Yeah, I mean, there's been like a steady stream of firms, you know, from smaller states, firms like Allied Investment Advisors in Montana and the Rice Partnership in Hawaii that have been steady.
So these are people who've been on maybe six times rather than all seven.
Six times, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
At a headline level, so how there's been 4 7-time entries. How many six-timers?
I believe our number was 7 6-timers and 13 5-timers.
Okay, so in 5-timers is where you're starting to probably see, you know, you're broadening it out a little bit. You're maybe losing some of that sort of state-by-state impact. Okay,
and then we have 15 who appeared on our list for the very first time this year.
Okay, that's fantastic. That's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think that could be a thing that people level at this report, which would be like, how different is it on a year-to-year basis? How many new firms actually make an appearance? And the fact that there's 15 completely new firms, and then obviously a number of firms who may not have even been on it last year as well, is really interesting.
But yeah, and firms of different sizes. I mean, $44 billion Chevy Chase Trust Company in Maryland, and then there's a couple, like, you know, firms at a couple hundred million dollars in smaller states.
Excellent. Well, that's a very neat segue, Sam. I don't know if you meant it, but if you did, kudos to Faye Kilburn, pod debutant, to talk about the smaller firms that made the list. So let's get into it. Again, I say maybe it's a criticism people level. Maybe it's just a sort of an insecurity I have about this list sometimes is, you know, is it all just big firms? You know, what are we really to some degree championing here? Is it just big firms with deep pockets who can afford to, you know, invest a lot and grow inorganically? But the answer is no. The answer is actually this report features a number of what we've defined as small for the purposes of this is sub 1 billion. We can quibble about what that number should be. Schwab would say, no. But anyway, how many quote unquote smaller firms were on the list?
Yes. Yeah, so we had 33 sub a billion firms on the list this year. It's up a couple from last year, I think, which was about 30, 31. So that is 25%, no, 21% of the whole list. So okay, it is a big,
excellent. Yeah. Yeah, so meaningful. Fifth of the list basically is firms that are sub 1 billion. And then you spoke to some of these firms because obviously like what we do know, and again, I've discussed many times before, is that the growth strategies available to larger firms are obviously not necessarily available to smaller firms that may not have that backing or just may not be able to sort of do some of the same things. So anecdotal and not necessarily representative of every firm in the country, but of those you spoke to, what were some of the things they were doing that they put their growth down to?
I mean, basically, they were very staunchly independent and very staunchly client focused. So I spoke to Gervais Capital Management, who was the Wyoming third fastest grower. And
how big are they?
156 million.
Okay, cool.
And
Sam, were they a first timer? Can you cross reference?
No.
They've been on before.
But their founder, Don Gervais, used to be Alliance and Goldman Sachs. He was JP Morgan. So he's kind of been at the big guys. And he said that basically in those firms, what dominated his conversation most of the time was finding new clients. And now his focus is on, you know, current clients, and that makes basically word of mouth referrals very successful for
him. So kind of it's parallels, I guess, to the firm you mentioned in Alaska, Sam, and, you know, growing wallet share from existing clients. And then I guess it sounds easy in theory. If you service them really well and do a really good job for them, they will do a lot of referral work for you.
Yeah. And there was a second firm, which was Delaware's runner up, Grey Fox, which are also, they've been on it before, I think, 699 million. So they also said that basically prioritizing the client service meant they're not spending any money on formal marketing at all, which is
okay, so again, sort of backing your service to please your clients enough that they become the referral engine. Easy in practice, and maybe one could argue something that you can get away with, but works at a smaller firm where, you know, to grow, you only need to add X many clients per year, whereas obviously the large firm, is it scalable, I suppose, would be the question.
Yeah. They would agree with this, but they agreed that there was a niche for kind of the background that they all had from, you know, these institutional firms, but with this personal touch that they can offer. And there is definitely like a client base for that in America, it seems.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, look, thank you, Faye. I'm sorry that we're going quickly. We're running over because we talked about Schwab for too long. So I'm sorry. Sorry, listener as well, but there's still some really good stuff to come. Some would say the kicker. He calls himself the closer.
No. Thank you for that.
Prior to the podcast, he may have referred to himself ironically as the closer.
I don't know if that's on tape.
It is now. Alec Rich, so you're here to talk about the other end. Well, actually, it's not the other end of the spectrum. Again, let's talk about this. 50 growers, we know from speaking to people in the industry that it is poured over by people working at PE firms or people whose job it is to find RIAs to invest in, because obviously you want to buy firms that are growing because that's better than buying businesses that aren't growing. And I guess, again, we've touched this before, at this point, seven iterations in, are there any firms left that come up on this list that, you know, people haven't already identified and tried to invest in? And you have discovered that, yes, in fact, there are many. So we did some work basically looking at how many firms on this year's list have backing from a PE sponsor. and thus how many don't. So what's the answer?
So it's actually quite surprising, I thought. There's 96 firms on our list that are not PE backed, 54 that are, which, you know, kind of sets up an interesting reporting dive and journey that we went on following that, just to see why that's the case. And you know, I think it largely kind of falls into three buckets of firms. You know, there's those that are just out of principle, really not interested in allowing private equity or outside sponsorship influence at all into their firms, just because of, you know, how it could impact the client experience, how it might impact advisor pay, things like that. There's those who, you know, can maybe see it happening eventually, depending on how their firm grows. Maybe they're still small right now. You know, maybe they're not up to some of the things that outside capital might be able to provide. And then, you know, there's those that aren't necessarily opposed to it, but, you know, don't see a reason for it, given they have everything they need for kind of the, they have kind of a longer term view of how they want to run the business, rather than kind of relying on the short 3 to 5 term window that private equity normally provides for them. So, you know, we spoke to a number of, you know, these non-sponsored firms, and it's kind of interesting to see how they are growing. You know, our fastest grower in Tennessee, Duncan Williams Asset Management, which is a $2.7 billion firm, relies on being one of the largest providers of retirement plans in the state, and they use that as kind of a natural pipeline to the wealth side, which is something that we see.
The old Edelman model.
Right.
Sort of.
Exactly. Yeah. And so they've been quite successful off of that. And they're eyeing kind of expansion also over the next couple of years, potentially through acquisitions. But, you know, I spoke to Duncan Williams himself, and, you know, he mentioned to me that, you know, they just, it's everyone in the company knows what, you know, they're aligned on everything, given that they, you know, can just kind of take their beat from one kind of central place and don't have to think about kind of the influence of outside capital in that way. You know, I also spoke to the third fastest grower in Washington State, who has also been, you know, our first place in the past, Brighton Jones. That's an $18.9 billion firm, one of the largest, you know, that we have that is not sponsored. And John Jones, the CEO, said to me, you know, he likes to have kind of this long-term horizon on, he actually views himself as kind of a long-term capital partner in a way, given that he does not have kind of a pressure as far as providing liquidity to shareholders and things like that.
Do they, on the larger ones, do they, I don't know if anyone said this to you, perhaps they didn't, where they have bigger initiatives, how do they fund them? So you mentioned that firm might look at acquisitions, or Jones sees himself as a long-term sort of, you know, investor in his own firm. How do they fund those things? Did anyone sort of speak to you about that? Like, or is it all just funded off, you know?
Right. Yeah. I mean,
off of earnings.
To an extent, it's from the cash flow of the businesses.
Yeah.
You know, in the case of Duncan Williams, he owned kind of a broker dealer beforehand. Therefore, it's kind of spun off and transitioned into this RIA. So he's kind of a somewhat well-off benefactor there. So I think you potentially kind of need that kind of a leader who can kind of supplement the business themselves, or just if you're able to kind of run a kind of prolific cash flow in the business.
And you that's something that's helpful
as well. You know, one of our fastest growers in Indiana, Valeo, which is a $13 billion firm, you know, they aren't necessarily looking at kind of just that kind of expansion, but they are just kind of focused on doubling down within their own market, trying to provide further employee owners there as well, and in providing things like capping the number of clients. You know, I mean, but along kind of paired with a transparent fee schedule, John Wortman, their chief executive, kind of said to me that that's just how they've been able to sustain, you know, high organic growth, and they're not kind of being forced to squeeze their business on the other end in terms of the advisor or client side because of private equity influence.
Excellent. Last question on this, and we do need to wrap up. So yeah, what was the, you touched on this I think already, but what was the vibe like? So of all those firms that you got to speak to of that wider number that don't have PE backing, how many do you, was your sense were open to it versus how many were like, no, this is my model, I'm sticking with it?
Yeah, I think the I would say the minority of them are really kind of obstinate to it out of pure principle. There certainly are, you know, other firms that have made, or that didn't make the list this year, but are out there that I've spoken to with that view. But I'd say that most, you know, maybe aren't opposed to it because of that principle, but just because they aren't ready. I mean, why are people turning to private equity influence? For the most part, it's like three main reasons, right? It's additional resources. It's to do, you know, kind of sprawling acquisition spree, or to provide liquidity to shareholders. And a lot of firms are maybe just not ready for those steps yet.
Yeah, it's a really good point, isn't it? As well, yeah, it could be also around obviously what the founder or majority shareholders, where they are in their lives, right, too. And, you know, if they're younger or don't need the capital, then, right, you know, why sell?
And a lot of these firms kind of have systems in place for their employee owners and trying to expand that base as well, which I think in a way, as long as you're able to continue to fund the exiting shareholders, that, you know, doesn't necessitate the need to bring in outside capital.
Excellent. Well, look, all three stories, we'll link them below in the description for this. They're all going to be live on the Citywire website by the time this podcast comes out. So for more details on that and the Growers Report, check out that URL, Ian Wenig.
Citywire.com/RIA.
Excellent. And on that note, we will leave it there. Thank you very much to everyone in the room, and thank you very much indeed, listener, and we'll be back again very soon for another episode of This Week in Wealth.